Horace Berry was just leaving his cabin, on the theory that he might be less bored somewhere else, when Buckman's head popped out of a companionway. Berry changed his mind at once. "Dr. Buckman, may I offer you coffee?" Protuberant eyes turned, blinked, focused. "What? Oh, yes, thank you, Berry. It might wake me. There's been so much to do. I can only stay a moment." Buckman dropped into Barry's guest chair, limp as a physician's display skeleton. His eyes were red. His eyelids drooped at half-mast. His breathing was too loud. The stringy muscle tissue along his bare arm drooped. Barry wondered what an autopsy would show if Buckman were to die at this moment. Exhaustion, malnutrition, or both? Barry made a difficult decision. "Nabil, some coffee. With cream, sugar, and brandy for Dr. Buckman." "Now, Barry, I'm afraid that during working hours—" "Oh, well, thank you, Nabil." Buckman sipped, then gulped. "Ah, that's good. Thank you, Barry. That ought to wake me." "You seemed to need it. Normally, I would never adulterate good coffee with distilled spirits. Dr. Buckman, have you been eating?"
"I don't remember."
"You haven't. Nabil, food for our guest. Quickly!"
"Barry, we're so busy. I really haven't time. There's a whole solar system to explore, not to mention the jobs for the Navy, tracing neutrino emissions, tracking that damned light."
"Doctor, if you were to die at this moment, many of your notes would never be written down, would they?" Buckman smiled. "So theatrical, Barry. But I suppose I can spare a few minutes. All we're doing now is waiting for that signal light to go off."
"A signal from the Mote planet?"
"From Mote Prime, yes. At least it came from the right place.
But we can't see the planet until they turn off the laser."
"And they won't. They talk and talk, and for what? What can they tell us if we don't speak a common language?"
"After all, Doctor, how can they tell us anything until they teach us their language?
I presume that's what they're trying to do now. Isn't anyone working on that?"
Buckman gave a feral snarl. "Horvath has all the instruments feeding information to Hardy and the linguists. Can't get any decent observations of the coal sack. And no one's ever been this close to it before."
His look softened.
"But we can study the Trojan asteroids."
Buckman's eyes took on that look, the focus on infinity.
"There are too many of them, and not enough dust. I was wrong, Barry. There's not enough dust to capture so many rocks, or to polish them either. The Motis probably did the polishing. They must be all through those rocks. The neutrino emissions are fantastic. But how did so many rocks get captured?"
"Neutrino emissions. That means a fusion technology." Buckman smiled.
"One of a high order.
Thinking of trade possibilities?"
"Of course.
Why else would I be here?"
"And I would be here, even if the Navy had not made it clear that the alternative was a formal arrest. But Buckman wouldn't know that. Only Blaine did.
The higher their civilization, the more they'll have to trade.
And the harder they'd be to cheat. But Buckman wouldn't be interested in such things."
Buckman complained. "We could move so much faster if the Navy didn't use our telescopes. And Horvath lets them."
"Ah, good."
Nabil entered, pushing a tray. Buckman ate like a starved rat. Between mouthfuls, he said, "Not that all the Navy's projects are totally without interest. The alien ship—"
"Ship?
There's a ship coming to meet us. Didn't you know?"
"No."
"Well, its point of departure is a large, stony asteroid well outside the main cluster. The point is, it's very light. It must have a very odd shape. Unless there are gas bubbles all through the rock, which would mean—"
Barry laughed outright.
"Doctor, surely an alien spacecraft is more interesting than a stony meteorite?"
Buckman looked startled.
"Why?"
The slivers turned red, then black. Clearly the things were cooling. But how had they become hot in the first place?
The engineer had stopped wondering about that when one of the slivers came toward her. There were power sources inside the metal bulks. And they were self-motivated. What were they? Engineers or masters or senseless machinery? A mediator on some incomprehensible task? She resented the mediators, who could so easily and so unreasonably interfere with important work. Perhaps the slivers were watchmakers, but more likely they contained a master. The engineer considered running, but the approaching bulk was too powerful. It accelerated at 1.14 gravities, nearly the limit of her ship. There was nothing for an engineer to do but meet it. Besides, all that metal, in useful form as far as she could tell. The clusters were full of metal artifacts, but in alloys too tough to convert. All that metal. But it must meet her, not the other way around. She had not the fuel or the acceleration. She worked out turnover points in her head. The other would do the same, of course. Luckily, the solution was unique, assuming constant acceleration. There would be no need for communication. Engineers were not good at communication. 14. The Engineer. The alien ship was a compact bulk, irregular of shape and dull gray in color, like modeling clay molded in cupped hands. Extrusions sprouted at seeming random, a ring of hooks around what Whitbread took for the aft end, a thread of bright silver girdling its waist, transparent bulges fore and aft, antennae in highly imaginative curves, and dead aft, a kind of stinger, a spine many times the length of the hull, very long and straight and narrow. Whitbread coasted slowly inward. He rode a space-to-space taxi, the cabin a polarized plastic bubble, the short hull studded with thruster clusters, arrays of attitude jets. Whitbread had trained for space in such a vehicle. Its field of view was enormous. It was childishly easy to steer. It was cheap, weaponless, and expendable. And the alien could see him inside. "We come in peace, with nothing hidden," assuming its alien eyes could see through clear battle plastic. "That spine generates the plasma fields for the drive," his communicator was saying. There was no screen, but the voice was Cargill's. "We watched it during deceleration. That spigot device beneath the spine probably feeds hydrogen into the fields."
"I'd better stay out of its way," said Mr. Whitbread.
"Right. The field intensity would probably wreck your instruments. It might affect your nervous systems, too." The alien ship was very close now. Whitbread fired bursts to slow himself. The attitude jets sounded like popcorn popping. "See any signs of an airlock?"
"No, sir."
"Open your own airlock. Maybe that will get the idea across."
"Aye, aye, sir."
Whitbread could see the alien through the forward bubble. It was motionless, watching him. And it looked very like the photographs he had seen of the dead one in the probe. Jonathan Whitbread saw a necklace, lopsided head, smooth brown fur, a heavy left arm gripping something, two slender right arms moving frantically fast, doing things out of his field of vision. Whitbread opened his airlock and waited. At least the Moti hadn't started shooting yet. The engineer was captivated. She hardly noticed the tiny vehicle nearby. There were no new principles embodied there. But the big ship. It had a strange field around it, something the engineer had never believed possible. It registered on half a dozen of the engineer's instruments. To others, the force envelope was partly transparent. The engineer knew enough about the warship already to scare the wits out of Captain Blaine if he'd known. But it was not enough to satisfy an engineer. All that gadgetry and metal. The small vehicle's curved door was opening and closing now. It flashed lights on and off. Patterns of electromagnetic force radiated from both vehicles. The signals meant nothing to an engineer. It was the ship's gadgetry that held her attention. The field itself, its properties intriguing and puzzling, its underlying principles a matter of guesswork. The engineer was ready to spend the rest of her life trying. For one look at the generator, she would have died. The big ship's motive force was different from any fusion plant the engineer had ever heard of, and its workings seemed to use the properties of that mysterious force envelope. How to get aboard? how to get through that envelope. The intuition that came was rare for an engineer. The small craft. Was it trying to talk to her? It had come from the large craft. Then, the small craft was a link to the larger ship, to the force envelope and its technology, and the mystery of its sudden appearance. She had forgotten danger. She had forgotten everything in the burning urge to know more about that field. The engineer opened her airlock door and waited to see what would happen.
"Mr. Whitbread, your alien is trying to use probes on MacArthur," Captain Blaine was saying. "Commander Cargill says he has them blocked. If that makes the alien suspicious, it can't be helped. Has he tried any kind of probe on you?"
"No, sir."
Rod frowned and rubbed the bridge of his nose.
"You're sure?"
"I've been watching the instruments, sir."
"That's funny. You're smaller, but you're close. You'd think he—"
"The airlock,"
Whitbread snapped.
"Sir, the Moti's opened his airlock."
"I see it. A mouth opened in the hull. Is that what you mean?"
"Yes, sir. Nothing coming out. I can see the whole cabin through that opening. The Moti's in his control cabin. Permission to enter, sir?"
Okay. Watch yourself. Stay in communication. And good luck, Whitbread."
Jonathan sat a moment, nerving himself. He had half hoped the captain would forbid it as too dangerous. But, of course, midshipmen are expendable. Whitbread braced himself in the open airlock. The alien ship was very close. With the entire ship watching him, he launched himself into space. Part of the alien's hull had stretched, like skin, to open into a kind of funnel. A strange way to build an airlock, thought Whitbread. He used backpack jets to slow himself as he drifted straight into the funnel, straight toward the Moti, who stood waiting to receive him. The alien wore only its soft brown fur and four thick pads of black hair, one in each armpit and one at the groin. "No sign of what's holding the air in, but there's got to be air in there," Whitbread told the mic. A moment later, he knew. He had run into invisible honey. The airlock closed against his back. He almost panicked, caught like a fly in amber, no forward, no retreat. He was in a cell 130 centimeters high, the height of the alien. It stood before him on the other side of the invisible wall, blank-faced, looking him over. The Moti. It was shorter than the other, the dead one in the probe. Its color was different. There were no white markings through the brown fur. There was another, subtler, more elusive difference. Perhaps the difference between the quick and the dead. Perhaps something else. The Moti was not frightening. Its smooth fur was like one of the Doberman pincers Whitbread's mother used to raise. But there was nothing vicious or powerful-looking about the alien. Whitbread would have liked to stroke its fur. The face was no more than a sketch, without expression, except for a gentle upward curve of the lipless mouth, a sardonic half-smile. Small, flat-footed, smooth-furred, almost featureless. "It looks like a cartoon," Whitbread thought. How could he be afraid of a cartoon? But Jonathan Whitbread was crouched in a space much too small for him, and the alien was doing nothing about it. The cabin was a crowded patchwork of panels and dark crevices, and tiny faces peered at him from the shadows. Vermin. The ship was infested with vermin. Rats? Food supply? The Moti did not seem disturbed as one flashed into the open, then another, more dancing from cover to cover, crowding close to see the intruder. They were big things, much bigger than rats, much smaller than men. They peered from the corners, curious but timid. One dodged close, and Whitbread got a good look. What he saw made him gasp. It was a tiny Moti. It was a difficult time for the engineer. The intruder's entry should have answered questions, but it only raised more. What was it? Big, big-headed. Symmetrical as an animal, but equipped with its own vehicle like an engineer or a master. There had never been a class like this. Would it obey or command? Could the hands be as clumsy as they looked? Mutation? Monster? Sport?
What was it for? Its mouth was moving now. It must be speaking into a communications device. That was no help. Even messengers used language. Engineers were not equipped to make such decisions, but one could always wait for more data. Engineers had endless patience. "There's air," Whitbread reported. He watched the telltales that showed in a mirror just above his eye level. "Did I mention that? I wouldn't want to try breathing it. Normal pressure, oxygen around 18%, CO2 about 2%, enough helium to register, and..."
"Helium? That's odd. Just how much?"
Whitbread switched over to a more sensitive scale and waited for the analyzer to work. "Around 1%, just under."
"Anything else?"
"Poisons, sulfur dioxide, carbon monoxide, nitrous oxides, ketones, alcohols, and some other stuff that doesn't read out with this suit. The light blinks yellow."
"Wouldn't kill you fast, then. You could breathe it a while, and still get help in time to save your lungs."
"That's what I thought," Whitbread said uneasily. He began loosening the dogs, holding down his faceplate.
"What does that mean, Whitbread?"
"Nothing, sir."
Jonathan had been doubled over far too long. Every joint and muscle screamed for surcease. He had run out of things to describe in the alien cabin, and the thrice-damned Moti just stood there in its sandals and its faint smile, watching. Watching.
"Whitbread!"
Whitbread took a deep breath and held it. He lifted the faceplate against slight pressure, looked the alien in the eye, and screamed all in one breath.
"Will you, for God's sake, turn off that damned force field?"
And snapped the faceplate down. The alien turned to his control board and moved something. The soft barrier in front of Whitbread vanished. Whitbread took two steps forward. He straightened up a half inch at a time, feeling the pain and hearing the creaking of unused joints. He had been crouched in that cramped space for an hour and a half, examined by half a dozen twisted brownies and one bland, patient alien. He hurt. He had trapped cabin air under his faceplate. The stink caught at his throat, so that he stopped breathing. Then, self-consciously, he sniffed at it in case anyone wanted to know what it was. He smelled animals and machines, ozone, gasoline, hot oil, halitosis, old sweat socks burning, glue, and things he had never smelled before. It was unbelievably rich, and his suit was removing it, thank God. He asked, "Did you hear me yell?"
"Yes, and so did everyone in this ship," said Cargill's voice.
"I don't think there's a man aboard who isn't following you, unless it's Buckman."
"Any result?"
"He turned off the force field right away. He was just waiting for me to remind him. And I'm in the cabin now. I told you about the repairs. It's all repairs, all handmade, even the control panels. But it's all well done. Nothing actually in the way for a Moti, that is. Me, I'm too big. I don't dare move. The little ones have all disappeared. No, there's one peeping out of a corner. The big one is waiting to see what I do. I wish he'd stop that."
"See if he'll come back to the ship with you."
"I'll try, sir." The alien had understood him before, or seemed to, but it did not understand him now. Whitbread thought furiously. Sign language? His eye fell on something that had to be a Moti pressure suit. He pulled it from its rack, noting its lightness. No weaponry, no armor. He handed it to the alien, then pointed to MacArthur beyond the bubble. The alien began dressing at once. In literally seconds, it was in full gear, in a suit that, inflated, looked like 10 beach balls glued together. Only the gauntlets were more than simple inflated spheres. It took a transparent plastic sack from the wall and reached suddenly to capture one of the 1/3-meter-high miniatures. He stuffed it into the sack head first, while the miniature wriggled, then turned to Whitbread and rushed at the Midi with lightning speed. It had reached behind Whitbread with two right hands and was already moving away when Whitbread reacted, a violent and involuntary yip. Whitbread, what's happening? Answer me!
Another voice in the background of Whitbread's suit said crisply,
Marines, stand by.
Nothing, Commander Cargill, it's all right. No attack, I mean. I think the alien's ready to go. No, it isn't. It's got two of the parasites in a plastic sack, and it's inflating the sack from an air spigot. One of the little beasts was on my back. I never felt it. Now the alien's making something. I don't understand what's keeping it. It knows we want to go to MacArthur. It put on a pressure suit.
What's it doing?
It's got the cover off the control panel. It's rewiring things. A moment ago it was squeezing silver toothpaste in a ribbon along the printed circuitry. I'm only telling you what it looks like, of course.
Yipe!
Whitbread?
The midshipman was caught in a hurricane. Arms and legs flailing, he snatched frantically for something. Anything solid. He was scraped along the side of the airlock, reached and found nothing to grasp. Then night and stars whirled past him.
The Moti opened the airlock, he reported.
No warning. I'm outside, in space.
His hands used attitude jets to stop his tumbling.
I think he let all the breathing air out. There's a great fog of ice crystals around me and...
Oh, Lord, it's the Moti.
No, it isn't. It's not wearing a pressure suit. There goes another one.
They must be the little ones, Cargill said.
Right. He's killed all the parasites. He probably has to do it every so often to clear them out. He doesn't know how long he'll be aboard MacArthur, and he doesn't want them running wild. So he's evacuated the ship.
He should have warned you.
Damn right he should. Excuse me, sir.
Are you all right, Whitbread?
A new voice. The captain's.
Yes, sir. I'm approaching the alien's ship. Ah, here he comes now. He's jumping for the taxi.
Whitbread stopped his approach and turned to watch the Moti. The alien sailed through space like a cluster of beach balls, but graceful, graceful. Within a transparent balloon fixed to its torso, two small, spidery figures gestured wildly. The alien paid them no attention.
A perfect jump, Whitbread muttered.
Unless he's cutting it a bit fine.
Jesus.
The alien was still decelerating as it flew through the taxi door, dead-centered, so that it never touched the edges. He must be awfully sure of his balance.
Whitbread, is that alien inside your vehicle, without you?
Whitbread winced at the bite in the captain's voice.
Yes, sir, I'm going after him.
See you do, mister.
The alien was at the pilot's station, studying the controls intensely. Suddenly, it reached out and began to turn the quick fasteners at the panel's edge. Whitbread yelped and pushed up to grab the alien's shoulder. It paid no attention. Whitbread put his helmet against the alien's.
Leave that to hell alone!
He shouted. Then he gestured to the passenger's saddle. The alien rose slowly, turned, and straddled the saddle. It didn't fit there. Whitbread took the controls gratefully and began to maneuver the taxi toward MacArthur. He brought the taxi to a stop just beyond the neat hole Sinclair had opened in MacArthur's field. The alien ship was out of sight around the bulk of the warship. Hangar deck was below, and the midshipman yearned to take the gig through under her own power, to demonstrate his ability to the watching alien. But he knew better. They waited. Suited spacers came up from the hangar deck. Cables trailed behind them. The spacers waved. Whitbread waved back, and seconds later Sinclair started the winches to tug the gig down into MacArthur. As they passed the hangar doors, more cables were made fast to the top side of the gig. These pulled taut, slowing the taxi, as the great hangar doors began to close. The Moti was watching. Its entire body swiveling from side to side, reminding Whitbread of an owl he had once seen in a zoo on Sparta. Amazingly, the tiny creatures in the alien's bag were also watching. They aped the larger alien. Finally, they were at rest, and Whitbread gestured toward the airlock. Through the thick glass, he could see Gunner Kelly and a dozen armed Marines. There were 20 screens in a curved array in front of Rod Blaine, and consequently, every scientist aboard MacArthur wanted to sit near him. As the only possible way to settle the squabbles, Rod ordered the ship to battle stations, and the bridge cleared of all civilian personnel. Now he watched as Whitbread climbed aboard the gig. Through the camera eye mounted on Whitbread's helmet, Blaine could see the alien seated in the pilot's chair, its image seeming to grow as the MIDI rushed toward it. Blaine turned to Renner.
"Did you see what it did?"
"Yeah, sir. The alien was... Captain, I'd swear it was trying to take the gig's controls apart."
"So would I."
They watched in frustration as Whitbread piloted the gig toward MacArthur. Blaine couldn't blame the boy for not looking around at his passenger while trying to steer the boat, but best leave him alone. They waited while the cables were made fast to the gig, and it was winched down into MacArthur.
"Captain!"
It was Staley, midshipman of the watch, but Rod could see it too. Several screens and a couple of minor batteries were trained on the gig, but the heavy stuff was all aimed at the alien ship, and it had come to life. A streamer of blue light glowed at the stern of the alien craft. The color of Cherenkov radiation, it flowed parallel to the slender silver spine at the tail. Suddenly, there was a line of intense white light beside it.
"Yon ship's underway, Captain," Sinclair reported. "God damn it to hell!"
His own screens showed the same thing. Also, that the ship's batteries were tracking the alien craft.
"Permission to fire?"
the gunnery officer asked.
"No!"
But what was the thing up to? Rod wondered. Time enough when Whitbread got aboard, he supposed. The alien ship couldn't escape, and neither would the alien.
"Kelly!"
"Sir?"
"Squad to the airlock. Escort Whitbread and that thing to the reception room. Politely, Gunner. Politely, but make sure it doesn't go anywhere else."
"Aye, aye, Captain."
"Number one?" Blaine called.
"Yes, sir," Cargill answered.
"You were monitoring Whitbread's helmet camera the entire time he was in that ship?"
"Yes, sir."
"Any chance there was another alien aboard?"
"No, sir. There wasn't room. Right, Sandy?"
"Aye, Captain," Sinclair answered.
Blaine had activated a comm circuit to both the afterbridge and the engine room.
"Not if that beastie were to carry fuel, too. And we saw nay doors."
"There wasn't any airlock door either until it opened," Rod reminded him. "Was there anything that might have been a bathroom?"
"Captain, did we nay see the WC? I took the object on port side near the airlock to be such."
"Yeah. Then that thing's on autopilot. Would you both agree?"
"But we didn't see him program it."
"We saw him practically rebuild the controls, Captain," Cargill said.
"My lord, do you think that's how they control? Seems very inefficient. But the beastie did nae else that could have been the programming of an autopilot,"
Sinclair mused. "And 'twas bloody quick about it, sir.
Captain, do you think it built an autopilot?"
There was a glare on one of Rod's screens.
Catch that? A blue flare in the alien ship's airlock. Now what was that for?
To kill yon vermin? Sinclair asked.
Hardly. The vacuum would have done, Cargill answered.
Whitbread came onto the bridge and stood stiffly in front of Blaine's command chair.
"Reporting to Captain, sir."
"Well done, Mr. Whitbread," Rod said.
Have you any ideas about those two vermin he brought aboard, such as why they're here?"
"No, sir. Courtesy? We might want to dissect one?"
"Possibly, if we knew what they were. Now take a look at that."
Blaine pointed at his screens. The alien ship was turning, the white light of its drive drawing an arc on the sky. It seemed to be heading back to the Trojan points. And Jonathan Whitbread was the only man alive who had ever been inside. As Blaine released the crew from action stations, the red-haired midshipman was probably thinking that the ordeal was over. 15. Work.
The engineer's mouth was wide and lipless, turned up at the corners. It looked like a half-smile of gentle happiness, but it was not. It was a permanent fixture of her cartoon face. Nonetheless, the engineer was happy. Her joy had grown and grown. Coming through the Langston field had been a new experience, like penetrating a black bubble of retarded time. Even without instruments, that told her something about the field. She was more eager than ever to see that generator.